as a proposition to the general society, then we ought not to impose it upon some of the most powerless members of that society. So on that grounds, we would oppose it. Now, if it was broadened to include all workers, which apparently the Employment Department is saying needs to be, that would resolve that issue. The second issue is one of the lawfulness of the proposal. What the Immigration Reform and Control Act did is very carefully and delicately balanced individuals' interest in privacy and interest in not having excessive government in their lives, in their work lives, against the need to control immigration. And the balance that was struck was that employers or recurring employment agencies are supposed to ask for any one of a list of documents. If someone produces a document from that list and the document appears to be valid, they're supposed to accept that document and not inquire behind it. And the reason for that is sound if you begin to think about how intrusive government agencies can sometimes be. It's just basically a balance between those two. Now, if the Employment Department is going to do verification like that, where they just accept documents from the list, that's perfectly lawful, and as I said, we're neutral as long as it's non-discriminatory. This bill seems to require more than that. It seems to require a more invasive, intrusive kind of inquiry into people's legal status. For example, every Employment Department office has a computer hookup to the Project Save computer database, and that's basically a way for alien applicants for unemployment benefits to check whether they're lawfully in the country or not, or lawfully entitled to receive benefits or not. There are flaws in that system. People come up as being ineligible or actually eligible, and there's safeguards built into the system so that people can receive benefits in the interim. But there's no way to do that with a job referral because you can't do a temporary job referral. I mean, either you refer somebody or not. So those safeguards would not apply here. And because those safeguards would not apply, Congress has said you can't use that system for job referrals. You also can't set up an employment verification system except under narrow pilot project systems set up by the INS that wouldn't be applicable here. So for all of those reasons, this proposal, to the extent it intends to go beyond the I-9 list of documents, would be unlawful. That was sort of my prepared testimony. I feel like I need to respond a little bit to and talk plainly about what's at stake here. It's not an accident, Representative Gardner, that those particular counties are chosen. Those are counties in which J. Frank Schmidt Nursery operates nurseries. Schmidt is the one major user in the United States, in this state, of the H-2A program. As Mr. Keenan noted, they began using that program at the time that they lost 350 of their 650 workers. Many of those workers were extremely experienced. They were in the pension plan. They'd been there for years and years and years. They were key workers. It's been our perspective, and we represent some U.S. workers who were not hired by Schmidt at the time that these jobs opened up. It's been our perspective that what Schmidt wanted from the program was not a workforce, but wanted their own workforce back. Now, that's perfectly admirable as an employer, and they invest a lot of time in training and so forth, but that's not the purpose of the H-2A program. And I think that part of what's really at stake here is not a search for workers and a workforce, but eliminating or lowering the numbers of referrals that are being made. And why would that be? Well, if you are referred a U.S. worker, you must hire that U.S. worker in preference to a foreign H-2A worker. That foreign H-2A worker that maybe has 10 years in your plant, you want to hire back. And as an employer, I can understand why somebody would want not to do that. But from the standpoint of public policy, the Congress has said, no, you can't hire that person back. He's not documented. He's not permitted to be hired. That being the case, it's important for you to understand that none of the jobs that Mr. Keenan talked about are entry-level jobs. None of them. They all require prior experience. Many of them require years of experience. There's not a shortage of workers at an entry level. There's a shortage of jobs and opportunity. There's a shortage of wages. Mr. Keenan also referred to the numbers of workers who didn't last on the job because the job was unsuitable to them. Perhaps it's because those jobs are very difficult physical jobs and they're low pay. Perhaps what we need is better wages and working conditions so that U.S. workers can go to work and fill those jobs. All of that is a much broader question than the question before you here, but I think it's important to put this in the proper context, that this isn't about somehow figuring out how to get entry-level farm workers. They have lots of entry-level U.S. farm workers who went and applied for these jobs. They didn't accept them because they didn't meet the minimum qualifications that they were imposing for a nursery job. Some of those jobs require 3 years, 2 years experience. Entry-level jobs require 90 days experience. I'd suggest that's the problem with getting an adequate workforce, not the problem of the referrals being made by the employment department. And that's what this bill is really about. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Any questions for Mr. Dale? Mr. Hughes, you have some written testimony for you. Do you want to testify?
No.
Colleagues, we have provided to us some proposed additional language to House Bill 2332. Mr. Chair,
I offered this proposed successful amendments on that they are in that form now. I think that I feel that, you know, after hearing from the nursery industry, being a member of the nursery association and a member of the Christmas industry, I know what a problem it can be to find seasonal employees that are documentable. I think that I don't know if we can go in the work session today and do this because the concessional amendments may need to have to be cleaned up a little bit. I'd like to have a chance to make talk with the employment department. So perhaps we could put the bill back in the schedule for early next week sometime. And if there's some way we can work through a labor process or something like that, I'd like to have a chance to discuss it with them first before we go down that road.
There seem to be some other questions that they need to answer to. That's information for you. And if you want to have these drafted into LC form, I would do that. Appreciate that. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2332 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1117. The sign up sheet for that. Scott Berry. And while he's coming, could you just give us an overview?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1117 provides exceptions to engineering regulations for persons applying to plans or specifications for constructing single-family dwellings or related appurtenance for buildings with grounds of 4,000 square feet or less and not more than 20 feet in height. And none of the Senate, it was a 25 vote.
Okay.
Chair, from Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association. This bill takes the exempt building portion of ORAS Chapter 671, which is the architect statute, and places in the engineer statute as well. That exemption covers one- and two-family dwellings and commercial buildings under 4,000 square feet. Being passed out right now is a letter from the Attorney General's office to Mr. Graham with the Board of Engineers and Surveyors, who basically states that the AG's in the AG's opinion, although it's not an official Attorney General's opinion, the architect statute already applies to the engineering statute. So we're just trying to take that and place it in the engineering statute and clarify the situation. In addition, the local building official still has the authority to require an engineer or architect if the work is deemed to be of a highly technical nature or the potential risk of life and or safety of the structure. So the building official can then basically send it back to you and say, you need some additional work. Also, potential buildings would be exempt, as well as hazardous buildings. Schools, churches would not apply. So they would not be exempt. They would have to have or be required to have the architect or engineer.
Does anyone want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. I think Mr. Berry has covered the bill very effectively. The only thing the division would like to add is that we are neutral in the bill and that we believe that there's nothing in the bill that diminishes the building official's authority as provided in the Oregon Structural Specialty Code to determine if the structure requires calculation and design by its nature. I think Mr. Berry has spoken to that. Be happy to take any questions.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pat Bridges, Director of Technology and Codes for the Oregon Building Industry Association. It's really a very simple bill, and it clears up the confusion as to whether the exempt building portion of the architect's law does apply to registered engineers. While you do have a copy of an informal opinion by the Attorney General representative to the Board of Engineering, this would really clarify it in the statutes and get this confusion resolved once and for all.
Any questions from the committee?
What's the sense of the committee? If there's any objection, we can wait till later and vote on this. If there's no objection, we can move ahead. Okay, let's go into work session now on Senate Bill 1117.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Starr?
I move Senate Bill 1117 to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation.
I'll give a motion, of course, to move Senate Bill 1117 to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Where's our clerk? I'll call the roll. I'll roll for it. Ice cream. Just have Cletus call the roll.
I can do it from here, Mr. Chairman.
Can you?
Hey, we get a well, 11-17 to engineer. Yeah, Richard, they decided to buy chair on the roll.
The credit on
oh, I can't score on that issue.
I can counsel.
Back day.
That's it. Yes.
Okay.
Please call the roll for us. Any much more?
Okay.
Son, I can son, yes.
This is my first time doing
this. Just pronounce the name, yes. Right?
Aye. Potter.
Excuse.
Devlin.
Aye.
Edwards.
Excuse.
Gardner.
Aye.
Okay, so
aye. Aye. Aye.
Hi. Star.
Hi.
Hi.
William.
Hi.
Hi. And Senate Bill 1117 goes to the floor of the House to be passed recommendation, and Mr. Star will be the carrier. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1117 and go to Senate Bill 16, public hearing. And who do we have for staff on Senate Bill? Janet. Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16 and go to Senate Bill House Bill 3400. We're just going to back at.
He works with outside.
Okay, getting back here. You've got to have some interest in this. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3400. Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Yeah.
Yep, you're on.
3400.
We have some people to testify.
Chair, committee members, Representative Zek, I think there's some additional bills, the Dash 5.
There's no amendment.
Should be in your packet today. It was received late this afternoon.
Okay, right in the mm-hmm. Oh, God, that's mad.
And what does it do to the fiscal on this thing?
And I've just received physical just at the start of the meeting today. Thankfully, the governor's budget, there's no dollars shown on the statement. They asked five amendments, page 3400 requires closed captions. The assembly amendments require, I mean, those are things that are already broadcast statewide.
Mr. Chair, Beck, if I can, on the fiscal, we've tried to narrow this fiscal down as far as we can, and what we've done, we've limited to the closed caption requirement just to the 2 hours a day that is currently being broadcast over the system. We don't have a final formal number. I think it's hovering around 50,000, maybe a little more. The proponents have indicated to me they have a federal grant which will help fund this as well. They received notice a month ago. They're here to talk about that and other things if you'd like.
Okay. And Representative Devlin?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Beckman, if I understand the amendments to the bill, it now excludes any requirements for cities, counties, special districts.
Right. You've taken out all the just legislative proceedings. Apparently the LAC puts out a 2-hour excerpt every day of proceedings, and we would be closed captioning.
It's called Carolyn Gaisley, and Carol, I can't read the last name. Pardon me? Sudeman. Okay. Here's just a brief overview here of what we want to accomplish and what you see. We have heard this bill before, so...
Mr. Chair, I'm Cheryl Sudeman with LNS Captioning in Portland. That's spelled S-T-U-D-E-N-M-U-N-D. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this revision of this bill. We are real happy with where we've gotten with this in terms of putting out the counties, the cities, getting it down to Representative Beck said just 2 hours ago out statewide, and narrowing and focusing it to what was actually requested by a hard of hearing woman before the session started to have captioning for this session. So we're really pleased with that. It meets our needs, the stated needs. We hope everyone will support this. Thank you very much.
And can you elaborate on the federal grant?
I'd like to ask Carolyn Gaisley to elaborate on that. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have applied for a federal grant from the Department of Education. The grant proposal went in March 1st, and we were informed within the last month that we will be receiving the grant. And one of the components of the grant, it's a program that's focused on local news and public affairs programming. So the whole intent of the grant program is to help people be aware of what's going on around them in venues like this one. And we have asked for basically close to matching funding so that the cost to the legislature would be $100 an hour. The federal government would kick in about $83 per hour for the captioning. What that does is it really drives the cost to do this down, makes it much more affordable, and makes the leverage to give access to the people of the state of Oregon through the televised broadcast much greater. So we're really pleased about the federal money. We think that it makes sense to take advantage of that opportunity. Any questions?
All righty. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Okay. We will close the public hearing then and go to a work session on House Bill 3400. We have the draft side amendments before us, and we may entertain some discussion of sending that down to fiscal, down to Ways and Means.
Would you need to send it to Ways and Means? Or
would the... we don't have a... It says indeterminate. It's on there.
Okay.
$100,000.
Right, and
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Devlin.
Looking at the dollars per hour and the number of days that we are, not the full number of days that we say we're in session, but the days when we are actually in session 5 days a week, it would look like the fiscal impact would be less than the threshold of $50,000, plus the fact that I think we have testimony to indicate that there people are seeking grants to pay for part of this cost. And ultimately, should this bill pass, it will have to be reflected in the part of the legislative administration budget that's approved for the coming biennium.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's really significant enough to spend on the ways and means. If it ultimately passes, we still have to take it into consideration.
Yes, sir.
But I don't think it will meet the threshold.
May I inquire with Devlin how he came up with that number? Because if you take the hot number for $500 an hour, times 2 hours a day, that's $1,000 a day.
Well, the figure that Representative Beck quoted me from that was approximately about $180 an hour.
According to the fiscal, it's $186,500.
This is done very last minute, I think, fiscal guesstimating here, based on, and maybe the proponents can tell us what is out there, but the national companies that are out there charge $500 an hour. Local companies tend to be lower end of the scale. We don't know who would get the bid to do the work. And again, I think with the, I haven't done the math on it, but even if at a low middle range with these federal grants, I don't think we're going to be looking at a lot of state money to do this.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the number in the fiscal, the range that is given, it is an actual sort of range for all different kinds of captioning from all different providers across the country. We are one of the largest groups that do this in the Pacific Northwest, and we're quoting, our original quote was $200 an hour. We've lowered that a bit to $183 an hour, and we've got matching money from the federal government that brings the state's cost down to about $100 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the fiscal, you have to really pin it, the state's responsibility at $100 an hour if you go with a local provider. And you can certainly, of course, send it out to a bid and choose a higher cost provider, but it's for the purposes of the analysis and the budgeting, it would be lower.
And if the grant isn't forthcoming, then the state, with this language here, still picks up the bill.
We can provide assurances from the Department of Education of their intent to grant the money.
Okay.
The administrator that I work with is out of the office until Monday, but I feel confident that we can get that.
I have a question.
We have a couple options before. We send this down to Ways and Means, involves a whole another set of committee hearings and the process for it to get through, or if we have some assurance, I think, that we're obligating more than...
Right.
I want to hear from Mr. Henderson also, I think. Pardon me. You here? Would you come up, Dave? Yes. Okay. You've heard our discussion up to now. I guess you've been behind the TV for me, so I couldn't see you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Dave Henderson. I apologize. I came in a little bit late and missed some of the early discussion.
Well, we're discussing a Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3400 that would provide 2 hours of post-captioning through the state broadcast each day during the legislative session, next session. And we're discussing the cost and the availability of some grants to help subsidize that cost, and whether it could be absorbed into the legislative administration committee's budget,
or and whether or not we should build a great community. So,
Mr. Chair, again, not having heard the entire discussion, we don't have any money identified in the budget for this service right now. We would have to review our budget and see, and there would still be the possibility of requesting additional funds should it be needed to go into our budget for the 9901 biennium.
Have they started working your budget down? I don't believe they've got very far with it.
Mr. Chair, I do not refer you to the co-chairs on that one. It has not had a hearing before the subcommittee yet.
Okay. So if we wanted to try to include this, it might be timely.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, it would be.
Yes, sir.
We were given, I'm not sure where this document came from, but it kind of displays what it might be during 60 hours. Be around $52,200 an hour, and if they match, it'd be about half of that. And if it's $180 an hour, it'd be a little less than that. So we're looking at somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000 possible.
Mr. Chair,
and that's for 10 hours a week. It's 26 weeks, 260 sessions.
And what was the dollar figure there?
It was even
$200 an hour, mm-hmm. And $52,000.
And $52,000. Now, if they didn't match dollars, you're going to cut that
by half.
By half.
President William.
I guess I just want to ask the committee that this is a House bill. So if we send it to the floor with the assurance that they're going to be able to provide us information about the grant, well, we're really talking about something that's close to $25,000 to $30,000. If information related to that changes, we'll have an opportunity to treat that again on the Senate side. My fear is if we don't send the bill out to the floor and get it down to Ways and Means, the likelihood of it coming out and making it to the Senate is pretty limited.
If it went to Ways and Means, it would go directly to the floor and the House concurrently from the
government.
Right.
It wouldn't go through the Substance Committee on the Senate side.
Right.
That's right.
Mr. Devlin?
I have the fullest confidence in the members of the Ways and Means Committee. The last time I checked, I think there was something in the neighborhood of 600 bills referred to Ways and Means, and something less than 50 or 60 that have come out.
Well, this committee sent several bills there already, Mr. Chair. A couple of them with my name on them. I haven't seen them roll one out of there lately. So.
I know that one of mine got wrapped into another bill, but the Legislative Administration Committee's budget isn't a huge one. It's not like some other budgets that we deal with in this process. And I don't want to encumber that budget or your ability to function. We can either send this down. Do you have any further comments, Mr. Henderson? We can send this down and let them know what we're up to, and potentially reach the wrath of the co-chairs, or go ahead and send it down to them.
Mr. Chair,
could you bring us some assurance, say Monday or Tuesday, of your the likelihood of the grant?
Yeah, could I fax that to someone?
To Mr. Moore?
96.
I've got your card.
Mr.
Yes, this is Blair.
In the absence, I certainly feel more comfortable sending the bill to Ways and Means because if, in fact, there's a vote, so it will come back. If it's not, then it will have to be weighed because, as you said, the legislative budget is not a large budget. And the ability for the legislative budget to absorb a $50,000 impact is much smaller than if it were, you know, a department of you name it.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we post this in for Monday and get us some information, and we will check with the Ways and Means staff or one of the co-chairs, and then proceed from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will close the public hearing on House to 3400. Is Janet back?
Yes, she is.
I would go back to Senate Bill 16 then. Back to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 16.
Okay.
give us an overview of Senate Bill 16?
Yes, please. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 16, you have the same draft version of the bill, requires health benefit plans that provide coverage for eye care services to allow enrollees to receive the covered eye care services on an emergency basis without first receiving a referral or prior authorization from their primary care provider. It provides that the insurer may require a referral for any subsequent surgical procedure. The bill also prohibits an insurer from imposing a deductible or co-insurance requirement for eye care services that is greater than the deductible or co-insurance requirement for other medical services under the plan. The bill finally also prohibits an insurer from requiring an eye care practitioner, which is defined as an optometrist or an ophthalmologist licensed by the state, to hold hospital privileges as a condition of participation as a provider in the health benefit plan. Mr. Chair, there is an A9 amendment, and that's been hand-engrossed into the bill. All the changes are on the first page, so we just included the first page in the hand-engrossed version of the bill. This bill did come from the Senate on a 27-1 vote, and it's non-fiscal.
All right.
That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Call Wayne Schumacher and Dr. Scott. I think you know who you are.
Hearing.
Okay.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Scott Nearing, a practicing optometric physician in Woodburn and the media past president of the Oregon Optometric Association. Seated next to me is Wayne Schumacher, the Oregon Optometric Association's executive director. The Oregon Optometric Association introduced Senate Bill 16 with the intent of delivering more cost-efficient, quality eye care to the citizens of the state of Oregon. Doctors of optometry are primary eye health providers who examine, diagnose, treat, and manage diseases and disorders of the visual system, the eye, and associated structures. As eye care professionals, ophthalmologists and optometric physicians are unique in the healthcare field, both because of the primary care nature of many of the services we provide and the specialized equipment and instrumentation we use on a daily basis in our offices. Eye care is different from other specialties, and the patients readily recognize when they are experiencing an eye health problem. Because the symptoms of an eye health problem are self-evident, patients self-refer to their eye doctor the same way they would self-refer to their dentist for a toothache. Recent national studies have shown that in open access systems, 70% of the patients who have an eye problem will seek the services of an optometric physician. Single office visits are more economical than multiple office visits the referrals often require. In many instances, primary care physicians will refer an eye condition only after it has not responded to their initial treatment. Delays in diagnosing some diseases can result in serious impairment. Clearly, evaluation is more direct and treatment more effective when previous eye health records and specialized equipment is available and utilized to correctly diagnose the condition as early as possible. Conditions such as iritis, acute angle closure glaucoma, and corneal ulcers may present themselves as a simple red eye, but in fact require immediate treatment to prevent significant vision loss. Waiting for a referral from a primary care physician can result in delayed treatment of serious eye problems. Attached to our printed testimony are examples of how direct access to eye care professionals could have prevented treatment problems. I would like to read parts of just two of the unsolicited letters our association members have received from patients regarding referral problems. One states, and I quote, "My HMO requires a referral before I can see you. This is both costly and inconvenient. What is the purpose of this system? It is a burden for the primary care physician, inconvenient and costly to the prescriber, and difficult for the attending physician," unquote. The second letter echoes the frustration of obtaining a referral, and I quote, "I work for Leschwab Tires, and in the past have had the misfortune of getting metal in my eye a couple of times. I have a good physician, but he doesn't have the equipment or skill to deal with getting the metal out," unquote. In attempting to be seen, for keratoconus, the same patient, and I quote, "arrived the next day at the Eye Institute for my appointment with the surgeon to find out they had not received the referral. I was embarrassed and angry that the Eye Institute had spent would have to spend the next hour on the phone getting the proper paperwork taken care of, unquote. These are just two of the examples of problems patients face when trying to obtain a referral for their eye problems. In addition to improving care, direct access to eye care professionals can reduce the cost of providing services by decreasing the time for treatment before treatment is initiated, as well as decreasing the need for multiple visits. Efficacy and the quality of care are significantly improved while costs are kept to a minimum. That is why this cost-effective model of direct access to eye care professionals for eye care has been so successful in managed care programs such as Kaiser Permanente of Oregon and Group Health. Direct access to eye care professionals works within the managed care system. Patients may visit the panel doctor of their choice, whether it be a primary care physician or their eye doctor. At this time, I'd like to introduce Wayne Schumacher, the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Association. He will cover the history and some of the specifics of this bill in more detail. Thank you.
Sure. Someone in front of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher, Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Association. In 1997, the Oregon Optometric Association, along with the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, introduced a bill similar to Senate Bill 16. During the debate of that bill before the Senate Health and Human Resources Committee, a number of issues were suggested that prevented that bill from ever reaching a vote of passage to the Senate floor. For the 1999 legislative session, we returned with a much better written and clear version of the Patient Access to Eye Care Act. We've attempted to address the major concerns of legislators, business members, and the insurance carriers. Several issues were raised during the 1997 hearings that prevented that bill from reaching the floor, as I indicated, and the major point was the concern for does it raise the cost of health care to the citizens of Oregon and to the Oregon Health Plan. We addressed the issue in two ways. First, we incorporated the language from a similar bill that was enacted into law in Georgia. Second, the Oregon Optometric Association commissioned the well-known actuarial firm of Milliman and Robertson to determine the cost impact of managed care if members of a health plan were allowed to access directly to a participating panel eye care practitioner. That could be an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. The MNR study, based on the original language in Senate Bill 16 that allowed unrestricted access except for subsequent surgery. A complete copy of the MNR study is included in your packet, and it relates to the impact of Senate Bill 16 on healthcare costs. A representative from MNR did testify before the Senate Health and Human Resources Committee regarding the methodology and the result of their study, but was unable to appear here today due to the short time frame of hearing notification. The results of the MNR study, which utilized the National Medical Database, shows that for commercial health plans, which would include the Oregon Health Plan, there is actually a savings in the cost of delivery of care. Their study states, and I quote, "The estimated cost of eye care under a gatekeeper delivery system for a commercial population is $1.81 per member per month, while those for a direct patient access to an eye care professional is $1.78 per member per month. That's a 3-cent savings. Copies of the study were given to the Office of the Oregon Health Plan and the Legislative Fiscal Office to determine the impact of the state of Oregon. Both agreed that the study was valid, accurate in its assumptions and conclusions, and there'd be no impact to the state if this bill was passed. The savings come from a more efficient delivery system of care and shows the potential to save thousands of dollars. MNR was also determined that a patient would, and I quote again, be able to be seen sooner by an eye care specialist, which would improve outcomes, end quote. And that, again, quote, many primary visits would be eliminated because patients will be able to eliminate gatekeeper visits, again, end quote. When faced with an eye emergency or an after-hours urgency, the PCP often refers a patient to the emergency room. Significant cost savings are realized by the elimination of most of these types of events. Most eye care doctors have provisions for 24-hour access. We have met repeatedly with employer groups, health plans, in an attempt to hear and respond to their concerns. Senate Bill 16 is not a mandate, does not require the inclusion of any services that are not already covered under insurance plan benefits description. This bill addresses eye health care conditions, such as red eye, corneal abrasions, foreign bodies in the eye, not vision refractive services or routine vision exams, spectacles, or contacts. vision benefits are usually a policy rider, and when applicable, allow access without a referral to PCP. The Senate Health and Human Resources Committee has passed an amended version of SB 16 that now sits before this House Committee. The language as it now appears, and I quote, allows any enrollee to receive covered eye care services on an emergency basis without first receiving referral or prior authorization, end quote. We believe the term emergency is highly subjective and open to interpretation by carriers. This will result in non-uniform application and put the patient in a position of having to decide whether the condition is an emergency or not. In the interest of keeping the bill alive, the Senate committee passed the A and Gross version of Senate Bill 16. But most of the committee members did express their concern over the term emergency. Even the health plan representatives had trouble explaining to the Senate committee how this language would be applied. Is an inflammation or is an inflamed eye an emergency? What about the follow-up visit? An injured eye that is patched should be checked within 24 hours to see if it's responding to treatment. If it's not, then more aggressive treatment needs to be administered to save the side of the eye. Is the follow-up visit that would incur, say, on a Sunday still be considered an emergency? Does that visit require referral? Will the provider have a problem obtaining the referral? To correct this ambiguity, our amendment removes the term emergency and allows for two follow-up visits after the initial visit.
Mr. Schumacher.
Yes, sir.
Are you concluding?
Concluding.
Okay. Yes, sir.
One other thing that we've asked for in our amendment is the inclusion of the that would allow the eye care providers to be added to the list of providers that's being distributed to the members. I had six provider directories here, all of them HMOs with the exception of one, only one, and that's the one that's not the HMO, does have optometrists and or ophthalmologists listed. They do not have them listed as providers. So consequently, our concern is that a member would not even know who they can go see, even under the current bill. That's my case.
Any questions for these witnesses from the committee? And your position on the amendments that are before us?
We are asking for your approval of the Dashen Amendment.
And I understand this is language that was removed in the Senate?
It was, it is not exact language, but it was language similar to, yes.
Okay. Let's visit about the amendment just for a moment. Okay, look, why don't you stick around, and we'll let some other people come up and testify who are here to speak against the amendment, and then you can have the chance to answer any questions as we get to it. Can you do that?
Okay. Call now John Powell et al.
Just a quick call to the lobby center and bring the rest of them. Can't be but two left.
Chairman Powell, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I'm representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. On my right is Ed, and on my left is all. Actually, not all of us are here. There are others who have had opposed us to the concept on the Senate side as well. Mr. Chairman, members, I'll just start out and let the others speak. This bill.
We are, and our members are somewhat. Tend to be supportive of the bill, and then there's the question.
Right.
So, since we are in the waning days of the session, you guys are professionals, so go for it.
The Senate Bill 16 was the subject of many, many, and long hearings and discussions for the Senate committee, and the bill did start out somewhat similar to what the amendment would take the bill back to, and that is a access without going through the PCP of they had all kinds of members, four or two different amendments at different times, and those ended up being rejected by the Senate. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the simple fact of the matter is, I think most specialists in medicine could make the same argument that's being made here today. I want to address the issue of what is an emergency, if I could. Under Oregon law that was passed last session in Senate Bill 21, you, the Oregon legislature, told insurance companies what an emergency is. And that is found, Mr. Chairman, in the Oregon statute, where it simply says that an emergency medical condition means a medical condition that manifests itself by symptoms of sufficient severity that a prudent layperson possessing an average knowledge of health and medicine would reasonably expect that failure to receive immediate medical attention would place the health of the person or fetus, in the case of a pregnant woman, in serious jeopardy. And, Mr. Chairman, that is Oregon law, and we all have to use basically that definition of an emergency, and it appears in our policy. So it is very clear to us when an emergency is, and it's when our insured thinks that their health is threatened, whether it be something in your eye and your eyesight might be in jeopardy, or something in poke through your skin elsewhere would be considered an emergency. So if you seek out medical treatment on that basis, it is considered an emergency and thus reimbursable under the health service contract. So we find that the amendments that are being brought to you today go beyond the scope of what the bill did as it came to you. And as it came to you, it basically was a restatement of existing law, and that is, in the case of an emergency, a person can go to any provider. Our contract at Regents provides that if you feel your health is threatened, get to a facility or a medical practitioner. And under that provision, it would be paid for. And I think every health plan in Oregon has been amended since last session to account for that definition of emergency. I would simply say also in terms of cost, in most cases a PCP or your personal care physician, in most HMO contracts they are capitated. That means they're not charged on a service-by-service call. They are paid a monthly fee to provide services for the people insured under that contract. And thus, because you go to that person does not mean that the costs are higher. And thus the savings issue, I think, is much more complicated than perhaps is easy to understand in the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Ann. I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I understand the need to be brief on this discussion. I will make just a couple of comments. What happened to this bill on the Senate side was it was originally presented as a bill to deal with emergency circumstances, and that was the way the bill came out. However, in a number of discussions we had with the proponents, we realized that the objective actually was to make them primary care providers for eye medical care services, which was a whole host, raised a whole host of other issues. Ultimately, it ended up being passed out related only to emergency services. There are others who can explain, and we could explain in some considerable detail, what the issues are that are attendant with becoming a primary care provider for eye services outside of other plan requirements. But that was what the gist of the debate was that took place on the Senate side. With the amendments, this new language then makes the bill into a new mandate, and in fact, language in the bill exempts itself from the mandated provisions that apply in the insurance code presently. With regard to the cost analysis, I did ask the HIAA actuary to review it. They found the assumptions a little on the weak side, and in fact, even the own actuarial analysis concludes that there will be an increased utilization if the direct access provisions were enacted. A couple of other points regarding the Oregon Health Plan. This bill does not apply to the Oregon Health Plan, and thus there is no fiscal impact from the OMAP on this issue. I've had a number of discussions with Hirsch Crawford about this, and should the bill be amended to include the Oregon Health Plan, they would have a a fiscal impact to report. Another issue that was included in the fiscal analysis was that the bill was to affect Medicare supplement plans. It does not affect those either. Those are the, in summary, I just wanted to focus on some of the costs and some of the comments that you've heard by the proponents, but we could live with the amendment dealing with the emergency provisions. With the adoption of these amendments, it takes us back to the same debate that we had on the Senate side, and thus we would oppose the addition of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Dave Fiskum, representing Providence Health Plans and Pacific Care of Oregon. Mindful of your instructions, I'll be very brief and reiterate one point. I would encourage you to honor the compromise we worked out in the Senate under the leadership of Senator Bill Fisher. We've worked for hours and hours in public hearings and negotiations behind the scenes to produce the compromise you have before you, Senate Bill 15. I believe that it responds directly and expressly to the problem brought to that committee by the Oregon Optometric Association, which is access, direct access to optometrists for emergency care. Senate Bill 16 in the form before you does it. The amendments don't do it. With that, I'll stop and yield to my colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, ODX Health Plans, attempting to be professional. I will agree with my colleagues. This is deja vu all over again in terms of Senate Bill 16 in its original form. We support the amendments as produced in the Senate and would urge you not to adopt the amendments before you today. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am neither et nor al. I am Jody Fisher with the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. I am rarely on the stand with insurers. I am today. We have no objections to the version, the A and Gross version of Senate Bill 16 that you have in front of you. In fact, we think the Senate did a great job in narrowing this bill to the nub of the problem, which is what Dr. Nearing described, is a patient who comes to an optometrist on an emergency with something in their eye and needs it taken care of immediately. This bill, as it's before you, as amended, takes care of those situations. We also, we also don't have a problem with direct access to optometrists for vision care, which is in fact what patients have now. If you have vision care in your plan, you can go see an optometrist for vision care. What we object to is direct care for medical or direct access for medical eye care without having to be referred by a medical doctor or without a requirement that if you find something, you have to go back and see a medical doctor. That's what we're concerned about. What the amendments to this bill do is essentially guarantee that a patient will see an optometrist for at least three visits for a medical eye care problem. Could be anything from serious things like glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy, and you would never see a medical doctor. I would hope what these amendments do is to resurrect them is go back to sort of the start or the word go on this bill after we've had several, many, many work sessions. And if you're going to do that, I would hope you would also resurrect our amendment, which was there at the same time, that said if in fact an optometrist discovers what's called diabetic retinopathy, that they be referred to a medical eye doctor or an ophthalmologist. The reason is, and very quickly, is an eye exam is one of the best ways that you can detect diabetes. If you detect diabetes, you need treatment for the full body by a medical doctor, and you are, in fact, in danger of blindness and need to see an ophthalmologist who is the only person who can treat diabetic retinopathy. And with that, I'll stop.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon Medical Association here simply to share with you the OMA's support of Senate Bill 16 as you see it before you, and in opposition to the -85 amendment. We are here also to help support our member ophthalmologists on this issue.
Okay, you had a prior rotation. Thank
you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm here representing Kaiser Permanente. I have submitted a written statement which details the reasons that Kaiser opposed the original bill. I'd like to make two quick points. First of all, I'd like to compliment the proponents of the bill for giving me a reason to oppose the bill here, because their amendments do go back to the original bill which we've opposed. And those are objectionable. Despite the fact that Kaiser provides direct access to optometric care within our own system. What this bill does with the proposed amendments, with the -9 amendment, is make it an any willing provider bill that mandates that insurance pay for any optometrist who provides services to Kaiser Permanente members.
that is objectionable. The Kaiser has always been a significant concern of ours, and the Dash 9 amendments would revert to that kind of a proposal. Secondly, I'd like to point out that the proponents mentioned a concern of an employee of Les Schwab. I believe that Les Schwab is a self-insured employer, and that even if this bill were passed, state law would not affect the benefits that that employer has to offer. Self-insured employers are exempt under federal law, and so bills like this wouldn't affect them. It may be a problem for Les Schwab, but it's not one that can be addressed in this building. Thank you.
Questions, colleagues?
I just wanted to see.
Commissioner Gardner?
On the A9 amendment on line 7, everybody kept mentioning their objection to taking out solely on an emergency basis, but their support for the emergency basis. Even on an emergency basis, what's the objection to including the name and professional title of the eye care professional in the in distributions to enrollees or health plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, I can respond as of the minute. The objection is that we're already required to do that, and we do that in our material, so it seems redundant to require it in an additional bill where it's something that was required last session instead of 21 patient protection act.
Is it required of everyone currently under Senate Bill 21?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, that's our understanding of the law.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Williams.
Follow up on Representative Gardner's question. I guess I'm interested in the rest of those in the train that just testified. also agree with Mr. Bishop's statement that Senate Bill 21, in fact, did require the inclusion of the name and professional title of any eye care practitioner as a participating provider. Is that everybody else's understanding? You can all just give an affirmative nod if you think it is.
Or blank list if you don't know.
Mr. Chairman, again, John Powell for Regents, Bluegrass and Steel of Oregon. Chairman, members, it obviously was not specific to any one particular category of provider. And, I'll go back and look at the Senate Bill 21 law.
Mr. Chairman, John, do you have an objection to that portion of
Mr. Chairman,
the amendment? I mean, I understand your objections to the initial visit and the two follow-ups. Do you have an objection to that, please?
Mr. Chairman, again, we do not think that it is necessary if, in fact, the panel of providers that's currently being provided is adequate to give people access to the health care offered under their policy. And as I said, I'm not sure how this equates to the Senate Bill 21 requirement. I'll have to go back and see what we're doing right now. In this case, what you're doing is allowing, as I understand it, basically people to go to anybody, even to any person for emergency care, so we couldn't list, unless we listed every optometrist in Oregon, anybody you might potentially be able to go to, which is the case now in an emergency if you went to somebody.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I apologize, John, it's probably you get to the Rules Committee, is we don't have necessarily the substantive knowledge having sat on some of those other committees that we talked to. But it looks to me like what this is, that it says include the name, professional title of any eye care practitioner with a participating provider on the provider list. So it's limited only to participating providers, not necessarily to everybody out there that they might happen to go to in an emergency situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, if I could complicate the discussion a bit. What you have goes back to part of the discussions we had over the Senate side, and it is whether or not an optometrist becomes a primary care provider for medical eye care services. And that was what you just heard Jody Fisher speak to. In the booklets, what you have is a listing of primary care providers, who are the folks that provide your routine medical services, physicals, treatments, or whatever it is you may have. Then you also have your specialty providers. And you would find that the optometrist generally would be identified as the specialty providers, but they would not be identified as primary care providers. And that's the distinction. And we never did
resolve the issue other than through the emergency language as to whether or not the intent of the legislation was to make these individuals four primary care providers for purposes of eye care services. Certainly a literal reading of the bill would suggest that that is what the intent was, and thus that was the reason for the objection of including the optometrist as primary care providers in a medical booklet, because even a layperson would generally recognize that your optometrist is not going to be your primary care provider. The issue is somewhat further complicated by the fact that this was another issue on this that was not resolved on the Senate side, was that you can have a basic medical plan and you can have a vision option that is in conjunction with your medical plan. You can have separate provider groups that have contracted for separate services with the vision option. And those individuals could be separate from even your specialist within your regular medical plan. And the bill is inadequate in resolving those kinds of issues as well. So with the language restricting the provisions to emergency services, those issues went away. But in essence, that whole discussion about a primary care physician, a la the optometrist being identified in a provider booklet, that was what the discussion was that surrounded those kinds of concerns. And those were never, as I said, those were never resolved in terms of the discussions that we had on the Senate side.
You served your purpose.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just impart one more thing. The amendment that's been referred to here is two follow-up visits. I don't know how that reads to you, but as I understand the amendment, it would, after the word provider on line 16, say, after an initial visit or two follow-up visits or for any subsequent surgical procedures. And there's an or between all of those, and I don't know at what point the requirement could be added. Because that sentence would read, the insurer may require an enrollee to receive a referral or prior authorization from a primary care provider after an initial visit or two follow-up visits or any subsequent surgical procedures. Now, that would mean after the surgical procedure. I don't know how that reads to you, but it doesn't read conclusive to me.
All right, for the questions from the committee. What I think we'll do is open a work session and get the census from the members of the committee. I'm getting some notes kind of passed up here as to what some of the census, some of the members are, and so we'll open a work session and have some discussion. Listen to Beck.
I guess it is hard, Rushman Williams, to comment about being sitting on this august committee. It is difficult dealing with issues we haven't had a chance to explore all session. I guess I'm a little troubled by having a bill that seems to have been worked out in the Senate come over to us with some changes that may have some merit, but it's disrupting a work group that, you know, worked something out, maybe not totally the satisfaction of all parties, but I guess I'm a little reluctant to
with
the amendment, given that context.
Okay. Mr. Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I did not actually, there's so many bills are traveling right now. Someone may have tried to notify me that it's going to get through. I did not know this amendment was coming forward. And the difficulty I'm having now, implications of this amendment that I would support, and there might be implications of this amendment that I would oppose, because there seems to be some disagreement about what the amendment actually does. And I'd like to get a clear understanding of what the amendment actually does, or clarified before we voted on the amendment or voted ultimately on the bill. This is obviously a Senate bill we have still time to deal with Senate bills. The parties still have time to meet outside of this committee and to resolve their conflicts or not resolve them. But I think getting amendments that people are giving me the impression of it's the first time that they've seen it. At this juncture and trying to take an action today seems premature on the Senate side.
Mr. Welch?
Mr. Chair, I certainly respect the optometrist, but I always have problems with the scope of practice issues, and I believe this one has been worked on considerably, and I certainly respect that, too. I think a portion of this amendment wouldn't be so bad when, as far as when we're talking name and professional titles here, if they're already part of the provider list, but I cannot, at this point in time, support, and I agree with some of the other members that possibly it's a little fuzzy in what we're trying to accomplish here, too, in the rest of this, but I think we need to respect the initial work group and what they have worked on. When they come to an agreement and it's established, and it has been over on the Senate side, that a lot of work's been done on that, and it's maybe going too far.
Further comments from the committee?
Yes, Chair.
Yes, Ms. Carr.
I understand that there were amendments on the Senate side. I don't understand necessarily that there was a work group that everybody at the table agreed to the amendments on the Senate side. Was there a work group on the Senate side in this that everybody agreed to the amendments that were adopted on the Senate side?
Mr. Cross, you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here representing the Oregon Optometric Association. Yes, there was a work group, and they met at least three times, I believe four times, on trying to develop some consensus language. Unfortunately, the efforts of that work group were not agreed upon by all parties, and in fact, the actual language that was being addressed in this amendment regarding the emergency, the restriction to emergency conditions was language that didn't come out of work group. It appeared at the final work session of the Senate committee and was offered by managed care. So it was a proposal that was not compromised on. At that point, the Oregon Optometric Association did support the adoption of the bill in the Senate to keep the bill moving forward, but with the intention of our concern being patients don't know whether they meet the statutory definition of emergency when they have an eye care problem, and they self-refer themselves to the optometrist or ophthalmologist. So our concern was definition and what its application would mean to patients with eye care problems. So that's what prompted our going back to this amendment, which is not considered. I think the last phase, the last language that the work group had worked with was initial visit and four follow-ups. And managed care did not agree with that nor support it. And it was at that point that kind of the work group sort of fell apart. We did agree to some other changes and remove some provisions that the opponents had, resisted in the process, but we never did get concurrence on the final.
Mr. Chair, is it fair to say that the optometrist compromised and the opponents did not?
I guess that's how we would probably perceive it. Their opinion differs from ours as to, for example, we believe it covers the Oregon Health Plan, and the Legislative Council has been asked on several different occasions whether the current language includes the Oregon Health Plan. The attorney says, yes, it does. They don't agree. I guess there are areas that we believe the proposal is not any willing provider. The language is pretty clear. They continue to disagree with that interpretation. So I guess our feeling is they're probably, we feel like we certainly made a sincere effort to address their concerns. However, bottom line is they're not they were not ready to address the ability of the coverage reimbursement of eye care for a patient that does end up, you know, going through an optometrist that may be a provider, but may not have that pre-authorization.
Yes, sir.
After the amendments were adopted in the Senate committee, you, the optometrist said, okay, we'll support it to get through and go into the House. Did you ever tell the opponents of this bill that you were going to propose amendments to the bill and on the House side to satisfy your concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, earlier this week we had still not gotten a copy of, in fact, we just got the LC draft probably about 2 o'clock. And, in fact, a good point was made by Mr. Powell about the reading on line 4, that initial, after an initial visit or 2 visits, that should be after an initial visit and 2 visits. But we did not have time to get that clarification. But I did earlier this week inform one of the representatives of the managed care organizations of the concept.
Yes,
Mr. Carr.
You know, I'm concerned that this bill has been posted, but we're going to hear this bill. And the only folks that lobbied me on the bill were the optometrists. I don't believe, and I've lobbied on a lot of bills, but I don't think any member of this came up to testify in opposition to this bill talked to me prior to this hearing. And that's unfortunate. Apparently, at least one member of that group was notified that these amendments were in the works. And so that's troubling to me that we're put in this situation.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from the committee?
Yes, it's been Beck. I just want to explore. My mind goes in and out. Bill, maybe you want to stay up here. In layman's terms, what we're trying to do here, and maybe I can state it and you can say yes or no. We're trying to let someone come in for or an optometrist to get eye care and get covered in non-emergency situations. Is that correct? No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck.
Non-surgical eye care.
I would, I guess, characterize it as abnormal or I don't know how you define
not overly complicated. Not overly complicated eye care services from optometrists. Non-emergency. And apparently that's not allowed. I can't go into an optometrist. My eyes itching or something's going on for a couple of days. I can't go into an optometrist today and have my glasses doctor. I can't go in and get see him and expect to get covered under current law. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vick, I don't want to walk your vision, your refraction, your glasses, you would pay separate coverage for that. That's a rider and that would be a separate issue. But if you had a problem with your eye, you would not be able, you could go to that optometrist, but you would probably be paying for it out of your own pocket. You would not necessarily get reimbursed for it.
And this bill would mandate it, my insurance-covered provider to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, this would require, if your insurance carrier offers eye medical insurance, that they would reimburse you, or reimburse, in this case, the care provider, on their panel for providing that treatment.
Why wouldn't I just go to an ophthalmologist?
Mr.
There aren't very many of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, you would have the same problem. Ophthalmologists also are not considered primary care providers, and they would have the same inability. I mean, you would have the same problem of getting that pre-authorization to be able to see them if you were an optometrist.
Okay,
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to see, I saw reaction over here, and I think it's unfair at this point that maybe we allow, and Bill, maybe you want to stay up there.
Stick around, Bill.
We'll just turn this into a little fight here in a bit. Maybe Mr. Powell can report. I've got, I want to try to get a little bit better clarified myself on that. I'd like to see things clearer. It's an effort anyway.
I got some glasses.
In this question, I guess I'll pose to John. And I'll tell you my facts here. Right before the session started, probably because I was, tired and everything else, I got some infections, and one of them was an eye infection, and I don't frankly know quite what it was, but my eye turned red and it was itchy and scratchy, and after about 3 days I decided that I ought to have it looked at, and so I pulled off to my optometrist office there in Tigard and went in, and they checked me out and they gave me some stuff and it all cleared up, some topical antibiotic or something, I assume. I didn't ask him what worked. I guess the question I've got is, under your definition, or the definition that we have of emergency, is that an emergency medical condition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, I think that the issue is, did you believe in that circumstance that it was an emergency? Would you proclaim that as your pull-off as an emergency, feeling your health was threatened, or did you just feel you needed medical care? And again, the balance here and the question perhaps should be is, does your primary care physician and your health plan know that you did that and that they gave you this topical drug? That is the premise behind managing your health care. And that's why managed health care is set up like it is, so that those people who are in charge of your basic overall health care know what kind of treatment you've had and what kind of problems you've had. You could have a pain in your tooth, as was brought up a while ago, and it could be a heart attack. So, again, we get into the scope of practice issues as well. When you get into medical problems, Mr. Cross said if your policy covers medical eye problems, I don't know of a comprehensive medical policy that wouldn't cover medical problems of your eye. If it's glasses, that's a different story. That is a rider. But all policies that I'm aware of cover, quote, a medical problem with your eye. And a PCP, or your primary care physician, would, unless it's an emergency and you see that help, select the best level of care or the best provider of that care to treat that particular problem, and then also have in their file the fact that you were treated and have an arrangement to get feedback as to what kind of treatment you have.
Paul? Yes. I guess the thing that troubles me a little bit, John, is that, and I grant you, it could have been something different. I mean, it could have been a brain tumor. Maybe it was. I knew it was in my eye. It was a Saturday by the time it got serious enough that it was bothering me, and I knew that I could get my optometrist to see me, and I stopped off at the Payless on my way by, and I had my prescription, and within an hour, I was doing something with it. And I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have gotten in to see my primary care physician on a weekend. Without that. So I would have had to end up going to potentially the emergency center, down the street that covers my plan, and actually, sat in their waiting room and seen an MD who didn't have the doohickey that would have fit around my face and looked into my eyeball. And so that's the trouble I've got with this. I mean, when my tooth hurts, I go to a dentist. And it may be a heart attack, but most of the time it's just because I haven't flossed.
And again, Mr. Chairman, the legislature did spell out the definition of emergency that we have to administer. We believe, and I can only speak for Regents, but in Fuhren and managed care plan there is 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, a referral system ready to get you to the appropriate provider of health care. And so if you had a problem like that, you need to call. And I think one of the things that's been lost in this whole discussion as well, 4 or 5 years ago, the ophthalmologists were supporting this type of legislation. They no longer do, because most health plans do allow people to see the appropriate provider. And that change has come about over a series of years to where health plans have maximized the efficiency of the system in getting people to the appropriate level of care. And there can always be, I would guess, a nuance of what day something happened. But again, if you felt your vision could have been threatened by that, indeed it could be considered an emergency, particularly on a weekend.
Assistant Gardner?
Yes.
I'm Representative Devlin.
And to play up Representative's scenario a little bit farther, your answer was if you felt it was on an emergency basis. So what I see happening is you go to that optometrist or ophthalmologist, you send in the bill to your insurance company. The insurance company then calls you up and asks you if you feel it was on an emergency basis and your health was threatened. So the determination of whether you're going to pay for it or not depends on your answer, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, I think it's perhaps more defined than that. I don't think they would try to trap you into saying it wasn't an emergency.
You don't feel that they'd ask you if you felt it was an emergency?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, I think they do have a systematic way of trying to determine if the care was an emergency or not.
Isn't it genuine what that is?
Well, they would know what the diagnosis was and what the solution was by the billing code. And as a result of that, that would give them a pretty good idea. Then they would ask your interpretation. And again, we're administering laws that were passed last session, which set that up.
One more, Mr. Chair. But if the code comes back eye irritation, and they'd ask you what your interpretation is, and the average citizen out there, not knowing what this law says, well, no, I didn't feel my health was threatened. I just felt it was real irritant. They wouldn't get it paid, would they?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, I don't think that's fair. I think because the fact you did seek treatment, and in this case it was a weekend, it would be assumed that there was a problem. I think the assumption would lie on that side of the equation.
Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions and just a short statement. The emergency medical condition, was that definition modified as part of our discussion in the last session where we had the issue over people that thought that they were in, potentially life-threatening situations where the emergency room physicians brought forward the bill that did pass, that basically said if you think that you're in that condition, they relied upon this definition. I don't know if we put it in place then, that you would not have to call for approval before calling for an ambulance, because they were presenting cases of people calling to get approval that were having the symptoms of heart attacks and waiting on the line.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Evelyn, as I recall, Senate Bill 911 was incorporated into 21, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So this encompasses that issue, and we worked with the sponsors of Senate Bill 911 during the last session incorporated into Senate Bill 21, which was the product of a huge work group of all the affiliated interests.
The second question, just clarified, we had a bill that was similar to this in the last session. Didn't it pass out of one of the chambers? Similar to the bill we have in front of us today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, yes, you had a bill on this subject. I don't think it passed either chamber.
Okay. And just a similar statement to Representative Williams' statement. The thing that I have also thought about this, and I hope you don't dislike this representation, but I get along fine with the care providers that I have, but my basic situation is if I call my primary care physician under my plan who operates in a gatekeeper operate position, if I have an immediate need that's not an emergency, it'll probably take me 3 to 5 weeks to get an appointment with him. It might take 24 hours to even get a return call from one of his assistants. If I have an eye care problem, and I don't have direct access to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist,
I will probably go to the emergency room and probably ultimately cost the plan far more money than if I went directly to the optometrist or the ophthalmologist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hedlund, I'm not offended by that. I'm offended by a gatekeeper who would put you in that situation. Because if you truly have an emergency with growing problems with your eye and they put you off 2 or 3 weeks, that is not the definition of the practice of medicine. And that would be very offensive to a health plan who's paying for those types of services. So I think that is a provider problem if indeed it is more than something that would be considered routine to put you off that long. If you have an itchy eye that's growing more and more irritated and you can't get in for that period of time, that would be an offensive situation to me.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just comment, I've not really been offended by the actions as such. It's simply just been a matter of that unless it's something that they consider an emergency, I basically follow into their normal route for appointments, and particularly in a lot of these cases, I mean, it's the nature of how the profession and the industry has changed. My personal physician, who actually is one in question, who I've always been very highly regarded, retired only a couple of months ago. But reality is I've been seeing him for 15 or 20 years. I used to see him for 30 minutes or 20 minutes. Usually under the new system, he's under the managed care system, he's under, I'm lucky to see him for 4.5 minutes. He's here seeing 8 to 10 patients probably an hour. And it's just relatively difficult to get in under those circumstances. But those kinds of situations, and I guess that's part of them, have been relayed to me, not just my own personal experience, but relayed to me by many constituents within my district and outside of my district in terms of their concerns about managed care.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and I understand that, and many times I hear anecdotal stories like that, and as you can imagine, the first time I hear them more frequently than probably you do.
I'm glad of that.
but I must say, in relationship to this bill, you could make very similar arguments, I think, if you had pain in your back or you couldn't go to the orthopedist correctly. I think you can make that argument with almost all specialty areas, as far as whether it's dental, eyeballs, your ankle or your foot. How far up your foot can you go to what provider? But I think you can see the emergence of these issues that can develop all over your body in terms of cycle.
This is Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cross, are you happy or satisfied with the language of the amendment? Because it does seem rather confusing as to what it means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, the amendment needs a technical change. You're absolutely correct. On line 4 of the amendment, where it says in line 16, after provider insert after an initial visit, the or two follow-ups should be and two follow-ups. And then continue on with the or the rest of the language.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes.
Okay, I can agree with that. The second or also, to me, seems confusing, the one on line 5, because it would then read or any subsequent surgical procedure. Is that the intent of the second or also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, the second or we do support the fact that they should get authorization prior to any subsequent surgery. So the way I would read that would be, however, an insurer may require the enrollee to receive a referral or prior authorization from a primary care provider after an initial visit and two follow-ups or for any subsequent surgical procedures.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me like if we go down the road of the amendment, it would be read much clearer if we were to ask for a new legislative council version. It would put maybe a a large A, B, and C, that would be clear, so it would be read them. I think Representative Gardner has written it down, although it's peeked over his shoulders, he's writing somewhere in the line of after initial or after provider insert a large A, initial visit, a large B, two subsequent follow-up visits, and then a C, or the surgical procedure. It seems that if we want to go down that road, it seems that would be a much cleaner and clearer way to do it. I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that. That's just my observation.
We're looking for clarity is always beneficial, and it appears that you might have struck on something that was in the environment. Colleagues, I'll leave it to you. We are in work session. We can set this bill again for Monday and take it up then, or I would entertain a motion on either the amendment or the bill as it stands.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, Mr. Beck.
What is the chair of the committee, the Senate committee, going to do with this? If we pass these amendments, is this going to conference, or?
We're going to conference, I believe. I have not spoken with Senator Fisher personally, but I understand that he may have some concerns. I don't know what the extent of those concerns are. Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be more comfortable with scheduling this for Monday. It'd give an opportunity for the proponent, and mostly if the opponent could send one of their people to us, for some of us to hear directly and ask questions, and so we can make a more informed decision on Monday on the amendment. Or I'd hear a better informed on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, if the bill isn't to be rolled over, I would like to see the amendment change so we would know what we were looking at.
We've given this a generous amount of time today, and we are getting on towards the end of session. This has been a fairly interesting discussion, I think, but we have to be cognizant of the amount of time we're spending on individual bills. And what we will do then is post it for Monday, and if Mr. Byer, you'd be willing to work with Mr. Cross to, or Mr. Cross can work with Cletus to get the amendments recrafted, or we can visit with the other individuals who are the opponents of the amendment. And I believe the bill has some support, and the bill will move. I don't want to see the amendment kill the bill. And maybe I can get a chance to visit with Senator Fisher personally. And we'll take final action then on Monday and try to dispense with it pretty rapidly at that time. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 16 and go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1013.
Thank you very much, Chair Simmons, members of the committee. My name is Mark Wiener, and I'm sorry. I think I jumped the gun.
Just a little bit. Pardon me? This is Cletus, this is Bill. Hey. Mr. Devlin, you somewhat familiar with this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and sit down. It's okay.
It's kind of...
It's okay.
Senate Bill 1013 deals with an issue that's come up in the last election cycle. There appears to be a lack of clarity in terms of defining vendor versus agent in state law. And in the last election cycle, for the first time, the Secretary of State started to question whether people that were providing certain services were actually agents versus vendors. It's the first time that they've actually done that. Most of the people that we've talked to about this consider these people that are providing these services to be vendors and not agents. Whether they're vendors or agents has significant impact on the reporting requirements for the candidate or the committee that they're serving.
And this was a bill that had bipartisan support on the Senate side. I believe the Secretary of State did come in at that time and testify in favor of the bill, agreeing with the clarification. And I think it provides a much clearer definition than we currently have in state law.
Okay, Mr. Weiner.
Okay, and I apologize for jumping the gun there.
Oh, it's all right.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, my name is Mark Weiner. Senate Bill 1013 is probably one of the more arcane bills you are going to see this session, and I very much appreciate your taking the time to consider it, and I hope you'll bear with me while I try to explain it. As Representative Devlin said, the occasion for Senate Bill 1013 is a change in the Election Division's interpretation of a statute which defines agent for the purposes of contribution and expenditure reports. It defines an agent as someone who is authorized to spend money on behalf of a campaign or candidate. And traditionally, this definition has applied to those who simply pass money through from the campaign to other vendors, such as agencies who purchase radio time or TV time. And the reason that the definition of an agent is important is that the activities of an agent trigger a considerably higher level of detail reporting for candidates and campaigns and those they hire to provide products or services. And my concern, and the concern of those in the Senate who have voted for this, is that the new interpretation of the Elections Division would lead to significant complications for candidates and the vendors who work with them. Briefly, to let you know how I became aware of the problem, among my other activities, I work with campaigns as a direct mail consultant, and the relationship is very straightforward. The campaign asks me to produce mailings ready to be mailed. I sell it for them on a per-piece basis, say 35 cents a piece for 10,000 pieces. And after I deliver the brochures to the mailhouse, I invoice the campaign for the agreed-upon cost. And in this case, I'm functioning as a vendor, and my clients report the amount they paid me in their C&E under the appropriate code, L for Literature. As Representative Devlin said, after the last election cycle, many of my clients received examination letters from the Elections Division stating that I was now considered to be an agent and that they would have to fill out something called a PC-9 form, which details how the money they paid me for brochures was spent. Both I and my clients disagreed with the interpretation. They did not authorize me to make expenditures on their behalf. They bought a specific product from me, brochures ready to be mailed, and the campaigns did not control how I spent that money, what graphic artists I used, printers, mail houses. This is all completely at my discretion. The only way I could have, frankly, been more of a vendor is if someone stuck money in my ear and the brochures popped out of my mouth. But based on the feedback they received, the Elections Division suspended the enforcement of their new interpretation and said they would revisit the issue after the legislative session unless new legislation offered more specific direction. Senate Bill 1013 offers that direction by tightening up the definition of agent. If this was just a matter of linguistic hair-splitting, I would not waste the committee's time. But I believe that the Elections Division's new broad interpretation of agent would pose serious potential problems. And I'll get to the selfish one first. This interpretation would require me to publicize proprietary business information, what I pay my subcontractors and vendors, or in the unlikely event that there is a profit in the activity. This would obviously be of great interest to my competitors. Similarly, I doubt my printer is particularly interested in having his other customers know what kind of price structure I've negotiated with him. I would understand if there was some compelling public purpose to be served by publicizing my internal business arrangements, but I'm at a loss to know what those are. But this interpretation also requires candidates to become authorities on my business. I heard from a number of treasurers and candidates that they had plenty to do without reporting on the internal vagaries of the direct mail business. And finally, the Election Division's interpretation has a slippery slope problem. If one is to say that campaigns must report the component costs of products or services they purchase, where does that stop? If pollsters hire firms to make their polling phone calls, do they need to report what phoners got paid? Do we need to know who the post office hires to print and design their stamps? I mean, it sounds absurd, but the logic and the principle is the same, and you run into problems very quickly. I believe that the intent of the legislature in establishing a category of agent was sound. It prevents a huge lump sum payment for a variety of services, masking what a campaign did. For example, it would not be appropriate to report a check for $100,000 that covered, quote, campaign services.
Mr. Williams, can you summarize?
Yes, about that.
I think the public has an interest in a greater level of detail in that. Senate Bill 1013 would not permit that very vague thing. It simply says that if you buy a single product from a single vendor, you can report it that way without having to get into a large number of financial details. As Representative Devlin said, it was unanimously approved by the Senate Committee and passed by the Senate 27-0, and the Secretary of State did, with some clarifying language, support it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Weiner? Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1013. Representative Devlin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 1013 to the floor of the engrossed version with the due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 1013, the engrossed version, to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Volunteer for carrier. Mrs. Devlin? Okay, and the work session is closed. We will, we are not going to get to House Bill 2830 today. I do apologize to some of you who have been sitting here waiting. We need to wrap this up. Is anyone here who wanted to testify on 570 quickly? Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 570. Okay. Mr. Graney and Bernie Bottomley and Mr. Vincent.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Mike Graney from the Office of Energy. Very briefly, and I have a handout that describes both the bill and the amendment.
The Dash 3 amendment?
And more detail. The Dash 3.
Dash 3.
Yes. Very briefly, the bill makes a technical correction to an unintended error from last session when the legislature provided an incentive for energy efficient appliances for individuals, for homeowners. Renters were left out, and it was inadvertent. It was not a policy decision. The bill corrects that. It was an oversight that the Department of Revenue pointed out to us in the middle of the past year after renters, in fact, had gone ahead and made energy efficient purchases. So the bill has a retroactive date to the same time that the original legislation was passed. The Department of Revenue also has no objection to that retroactive date. The amendment, in turn, makes a change to our business energy tax credit program that currently allows employers to provide transit passes for their employees to help reduce congestion. It's limited to transit districts. The amendment allows other transit providers that can both supplement transit districts and serve areas that transit districts are not able to serve. I talked to the principal sponsors of the bill, Senator Nelson and Senator Shields, and Senator Nelson chaired the originating committee of the bill of the Senate side, and they have no objections to the amendment as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley from TriNet, here to support the Dash 3 amendment. Just a quick background, the change to the tax credit that was passed last session is used by businesses who subsidize transit passes for their employees. They're able to get a tax credit for a portion of the cost of that subsidy. The program's proved very successful in the Portland area and as well as in Eugene and Salem at helping us encourage employers to work with their employees to find other ways than single car commuting to get to work. Statewide, we've had about 6,000 employees participate in the program. The limitation on this right now is that the only way a business can access this is if they contract with a transit district. So it limits it geographically to only the areas of the state that are covered by transit districts. It also limits it in terms of the kind of flexibility that a lot of businesses are looking for and how they address the needs of their employees. There are businesses that run their own programs, Intel, Tektronix, Nike, and a number of others Rockers Electronics all run their own shuttle programs, and a lot of them would increase the amount of effort that they put into those if they had this kind of tax credit. In addition, there are people outside of metropolitan areas in the Valley, San Bend, and other places who are interested in starting programs, and we would like to have this credit available to help encourage them to go ahead and start programs where there aren't transit districts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. My interest is in the Dash 3 Amendment, Section 8 of the bill. You can consider it a technical amendment. It simply changes energy efficient or energy devices and facilities are eligible for the investor-owned utility tax credit pass-through mechanism. I can explain in further detail if you want to stay here longer.
Okay, questions from the committee? And as we talk about renters, are you talking about what kind of appliances? They would buy a new stove, a gas stove, pay or some kind of energy-efficient stove, or what kind of products are you talking about?
Principally, Mr. Chairman, it's refrigerators and washers or dryers. Hot water heaters, but for renters, it's principally a refrigerator or washer. Okay. Those are the big energy savings, and the tax credit is based on the amount of energy saved.
Little sticker, big yellow sticker on the door, what it costs. And
those are helpful. Some of those comply are eligible for the tax credit. Some are. We have a list, and the dealers have a list, so they can indicate whether the appliance is eligible for the tax credit. Basically, they have to be about 20%. More efficient than the national standards for appliances.
Okay. So there's a select identifiable group of
yes.
appliances that are eligible for the tax credit.
Yes, that's correct.
And the tax credit would vary with the increase in efficiency, or does it?
Yes, sure. It's based on the watts BTU saved.
Okay.
On the, up to 25% of the cost of the appliance.
That's right. Okay. Yes, this is Edwards.
Could you just walk through quickly how that works? I mean, I go out and buy a refrigerator, meet the criteria, I could then send a receipt in, and therefore I get. Is there an income test for this? Or
Edwards, there's no income test. Anyone is eligible, except renters right now. Let's make that change. You get a certified form from us, our office, if you file with or have it for your tax return, and then you claim that credit on the taxes the next year.
One last question.
Yes.
The prices that fall under this, do they tend to, are they priced higher typically? Is that why this is an incentive to get help offset them?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they tend to be the more expensive models.
Okay. For the first time,
what a happy bunch here today.
Yes.
If Representative Edwards would like to have me shine a light on the original bill, I can't speak to the last amendments, but I did buy a tax credit available washing machine just over a year ago, and it was pointed out at the time in my purchase. I didn't realize it wasn't available. But you buy the machine. It was a rather expensive machine, but then you got, in this case, it was about a $230 tax credit. And just you put the form back in with your income taxes, and you wrote the check for that much less.
I'll have to sign it next time.
Is that camera off? That's back there.
Yeah. We run things with a heavy hand in this committee.
Are we in work session?
Sure. We're not in work session, but any questions from these witnesses from the committee?
One last question.
Yes.
Sorry, on the dash three. When we're talking about transportation facility means a transportation project that reduces energy use during commuting to and from work. Who's overseeing that? Who's determining that?
Chairman Representative Edwards, we would the Office of Energy. So this is part of our tax credit program. We define it by rule, and what we're talking about is either transit passes or fares charged by private providers or the cost if it's like an inner office shuttle. That's what we're talking about in terms of transportation facilities. It was a term that legislative council used to make it consistent with the other energy facility measures that are eligible for a tax credit. It's not intended, for example, to talk about highways or transit equipment or anything like that.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 570, and we do have the DASH 3 amendment. The revenue statement was prepared for the DASH 2s. I understand that the DASH 3s don't change it.
I've got to take my work session, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I closed the hearing, and I'll open the work session.
Okay.
We got it.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the DASH 3 amendment.
Okay, calls the motion for us to move the DASH 3 amendment to Senate Bill 570.
Mr. Chair,
any discussion? Yes.
I just want to, this is the transportation portion of this was something that I worked with Mike Graney on last session and Representative Cruz to get through a bill, and the program has turned out to be a great success in the metro area for people getting transit passes, and this was just to make it, I think, clean up a little problem that will allow this program to expand into other parts of the state that don't have transit districts. So this is a great legislation. I want to thank Mr. Graney for bird dogging this little detail.
Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question would be, I don't know who, maybe Rick Beck. Last session, I was in the session that was inaccurately identified in one of the after session report cards that had an 11% conservation voting record, and I was very disappointed I didn't get a zero. And I this bill, I guess I lose my zero rating on for whichever group that was.
The Oregon League of Conservation voters, I believe.
You must have voted for it. They had me recorded wrong on a vote, and it gave me 11% voting record. And I was very disappointed. It wasn't one of the members.
The bill that we amended this into had been sponsored by Representative Cruz and Senator Fisher at the request of former Senator Johnson, all of whom supported this addition into the bill. So I don't know if that was the bill that you voted on, wrong on, or right on, whatever the case was.
This bill before today is sponsored by Senator Nelson and Senator Shields.
I still am afraid that I may lose my 0% rating if I vote yes on this bill.
I think you've got one other vote. You're probably already up and running there already.
Well, pure intepidation, we will press forward. We have a motion before us, colleagues. Any further discussion on the motion? Or if you'd like to be excused.
Well, we got him in here now.
Is there any objection to the motion?
We need to
do a roll call.
Roll call.
Oh, just right. Don't need that.
Okay. Well, we will adopt the amendment. Hearing no vocal objection to adopting the amendment, and now we need a motion to move the bill.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, I'm the Senate bill. Fine. 70 to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Yes. Discussion down here.
No, excuse me, wasn't there two amendments we needed the most?
No.
All together.
That was the question. No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready. You will also vote for the bill.
Yeah. I'll walk the plank with you, Representative. Aaron, in order to lead the way, would you please call the roll in reverse order?
Hey, Bob, you carrier of two?
Aye.
Representative Bennett today.
Aye.
Representative
Bush. Aye.
Representative
Fishing.
Excuse.
Aye. The bill having received the required majority has moved on the floor of the House to pass recommendation. Why don't we assign this specific fact?
No, I think by
Liar.
Hey, I will be more than happy to share.
I would hate to be at the four more steps. That was good.
Hey, Representative Welch has requested that he be allowed to carry this bill. We will sign this bill to Representative Welch. And the work session is closed. And if you know the business for the committee, we are just...